Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everybody and welcome again to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. Thank you very much for joining us or downloading us or whatever it is you do with us. But anyway, it's good to have you, and for the next 1 hour we'll be talking to a man who was once the fastest man on earth. That was 30 years ago. His name is Richard Noble and he's still in the business, because this time he's going to do 1,000 miles an hour, except, of course, very sensibly, he's putting another man in the cockpit. We'll be talking to Richard about all things to do with land speed records, particularly his Bloodhound project, in just a moment. But first, I must tell you about our new subscription offer. And this is a good one. You can save up to £59 when you subscribe to Motorsport Magazine today. That's a lot of money. And you get a free Motorsport cooler bag. Yep. So that will make sure you have a fresh and cool lunch when you're trackside at your motor racing. That's what it says here. Was it? Anyway, well, that's a good present. Yep. I wouldn't mind one of those. Anyway, the prices start at $49.99. So just go to our website. That's motorsportmagazine.com. motorsportmagazine.com/CBP. That's CBP1313. Okay, good. Well, I hope lots of you will do that, because that way you get Motorsport through the post every month. Don't have to think about it. Fantastic. Okay, Richard, welcome, and thank you for your time, because I know you work 24 hours a day, 8 days a week.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, I can tell you.
Oh, good. Well, the amazing thing is that 30 years ago, well, come October, 30 years ago, we were in the Nevada desert, weren't we?
We were indeed, yeah.
And I was being a pain in the ass trying to get you to answer questions you didn't want to answer. But the upshot of it all was that amazing day in the desert when you and Thrust 2 did an average speed of 633 miles an hour. And afterwards, I asked you why on earth you did it. And you said, for Britain and the hell of it.
Yeah, and it rolled straight off the tongue. That's completely unprepared, yeah. And it's exactly what it was, yeah.
But is that really why you did it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the land speed record is just a fabulous thing. I mean, it really is, because you're pushing the boundaries of technology, you're pushing the boundaries of teamwork, you're creating these amazing machines. And it's just an enormous experience. And what we find, too, is that the world loves these things on an enormous scale. For instance, when we did Thrust SSC, our website ran 17 million pages a day. Sorry, 17 million visits a day. And it was the fifth largest website in the world. So, yeah, great sport.
And that was in 97.
That was in 97.
That's
before broadband, so it's all dial-up time, yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, I should have said at the beginning, actually, that after Thrust 2 in October 83, you went on to do Thrust SSC, which was driven by Andy Green, who's also going to drive Bloodhound in 2015, right?
2015 and 2016, yes.
And 2016.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to ask you a question that everybody asks me to ask you.
Oh, we're in trouble.
Yeah, well, not too much trouble. What is the point of it?
Well, there you are. Yeah, there are a number of things about it. It is one of the most exciting things you can do on God's earth. I mean, it really is. If you enjoy the engineering of creating a vehicle like this, if you enjoy the challenge of actually getting it marketed and getting it sold and getting the revenue together, if you enjoy the fantastic teamwork and camaraderie that goes around a thing like this, because it's not like a Grand Prix, which is just over in a couple of days. This thing goes on and on and on. You know, in Bloodhound, we've been together for 5 years on this. This is really a very long haul. It's just the most amazing experience, and thank God it generates a huge amount of publicity, and because of that, of course, we can generate the sponsorship revenue to actually fund it.
What is interesting also is that in 1983, when the name Richard Noble really first hit the headlines, it was a tiny little team. It had that sort of feel of, I guess, you know, the first of anything has that really nice feel about it. Everybody, you know, put in absolutely the maximum effort, didn't they? You know, never mind
my
sleeping.
God, they did, yes. Yeah.
How different is it now with Bloodhound, where you're spending millions and millions of pounds? You've got, I think it's 60 people working for you. Are you still loving it?
Yes, it's a huge challenge, but on a completely different scale, and it really is. The great thing, of course, of the smaller projects like Thrust 2 is that a very, very small, intimate team where you all know each other. With Bloodhound, it's a much, much bigger organisation altogether, but it'll turn itself into an intimate team as soon as we actually start running that car. Because, as you well know, of course, once you get the sound of the afterburner and the rocket and everything else going, people will just be absolutely wowed to death with this thing.
They will, you're right. I should have mentioned at the top of the show that our editor is with us, Damien Smith, and our associate editor, Ed Foster, who looks after all our podcasts for us. And they will be speaking. Okay, but I just want to finish up with one more point, which is... at the time of Thrust 2, a lot of us were talking, not to your face, but we were saying, my God, you know, is he scared? He doesn't look scared. Is he mad? Can you say now, were you frightened doing that? Because you were, when that car was doing 33 miles an hour, you weren't far off taking off.
Yes, we were within 7 miles an hour of takeoff.
7 miles an hour of taking off.
Yeah. And... on reflection, what we were doing was incredibly dangerous because the fundamental thing was that we couldn't model it like we can today. And so therefore you don't have the fallback position of all the modeling data, et cetera, in which to be able to compare your data. Also, our ability to record data from the car was very, very limited indeed. So what we were doing was driving this car faster and faster and faster into the very dangerous transonic speed range, where some of the airflow is supersonic and some of the airflow is subsonic, and a very, very small increase in Mach number can cause huge pressure changes across the car, and you can completely lose it. And John Aykroyd designed a car which would do it. It was absolutely brilliant. I could drive that car at 650 miles an hour with a lateral accuracy of 1.5 inches. It was absolutely astonishingly good car. And we set the design speed at 650 miles an hour, and we did 650.88. So all credit to John and the team. It was a great, great effort.
Absolutely. So they were a bunch of really clever guys. I'm sorry, I said it was the last one, but I just want to... You were and are a pilot.
I was. I'm not flying at the moment.
No, fine. But how did you train for doing that speed in a car on the ground? Because things are coming past you, I mean, unimaginably quickly, aren't they?
Right. Well, first things first. What was needed more than anything else was personal discipline. And Ken Norris, who was helping us, and Ken was the designer of Donald Campbell's Bluebird car and boat, and Ken was absolutely essential to the whole project. And he said, well, I own this flying club, and you better go and learn to fly, get some personal discipline. And that's what I did, and I did an awful lot of instrument flying and so on, and that helped enormously, absolutely enormously. So you've got that, and the impression of speed is quite something. Of course, you're on a flat bit of desert. It's a bit like being at sea in a boat, actually, because there isn't anything really nearby. But there are two extraordinary effects, three, actually. The first is at 650 miles an hour, you can see every single detail on the track go up and under the car. Okay, because what's actually happening is your mental processes are speeding right up, and rather like the last time you had a car accident, you know, it all happens in slow motion. So this is extraordinary. So the whole thing is very, very relaxed. And I remember having a long discussion with Nigel Mansell about all this, and we came to the conclusion that the whole thing, in terms of motor racing, was about processing power, the ability to actually process vast quantities of data through the old brain quickly, and therefore everything happens in slow motion. I remember one day driving at, I suppose we were in the 620, 630 mile an hour range, and the conditions, the atmospheric conditions, are very different. It had rained. And suddenly the car was covered with a shockwave-caused cloud, really. That's a very, very fierce cloud. And I remember looking out of the cockpit and saying, my God, remember this. You'll never see this again. This is really something. And then you come out of the measured mile, and the car had had a big cross-sectional area. It was very light, and it had a very big parachute. And so we deployed the parachute at just over 600 miles an hour, and immediately you got 6G deceleration. And the extraordinary effect about this is that under this extreme deceleration, it upsets your inner ears, which actually give you your balance. The effect is called a somatographic illusion. And you're absolutely convinced you're driving straight vertically downwards into the center of the Earth. It's an extraordinary experience. And then, you know, the G comes off very quickly and you're kind of back to normal, and then you're down to 400 and it's getting boring, you know. The other thing which is interesting too is at top speed, just you haven't really got time to admire the scenery at the speed, but at top speed you could see the mountains change on the horizon very, very quickly. You know, when you drive normally in a normal car towards the mountains, you know, that you see the perspective change. Here, the perspective is changing really fast, which is an astonishing experience. So that's about it, really.
Richard, what you achieved back in 83, it reminds me of an Olympic athlete that they spend years and years building up to this one moment.
Yeah.
And you finally achieve it after so much work. How do you come down from that? What do you do?
Damien,
next?
It's a bloody nightmare. It really is, because you've got a very, very close team, and you've got very, very hard and tough discipline in the organisation, and suddenly it's all over. And there's no reason actually for everybody to stick together, because we all came together to do this car. You know, nobody got any long term plans in terms of selling merchandise or whatever off it. It was over. It was absolutely over. And the same too with the Thrust SSC project. Very, very close team of people. Fantastic team achievement. And then suddenly it's over. So it's a big come down. And with Thrust SSC, the workload was so intense that it took most people about 2 years to recover.
So you must have been very relieved when SSC was launched, when the idea was, you know, mooted to go back and do it again and go faster.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was a great opportunity. The story is a very interesting one, because I was out on Bonneville with Art Alphonse and Craig Breedlove, and Breedlove then said to me, well, you know, I'm going ahead now, I'm going to build my next car. And then when I came back to Britain, all sorts of people started phoning me up saying, we can't tell you anything, Richard, because we signed non-disclosure agreements, but basically something is going on and you better find out what's going on. And I couldn't really find out what was going on, but a lot of people were sort of talking about this. And then suddenly I got a phone call from the McLaren Formula One people, who said, we've got a collection of sponsors turning up in a couple of weeks' time, and we'd like to show them something interesting. We'd like to show them a copy of your video. Could you do us a favor and send us one? So I said, of course, and didn't. And then they rang up again. Richard, it hasn't arrived. You know, oh dear, I'm so sorry. That's what a shame. Yeah. So I'll send you another one, and didn't. And after a bit, they were getting really apoplectic. It's quite clear that's what they intended to do. So we decided then that we would take them on. And really, there were just three of us. There was Ron Ayres, who, of course, was the aerodynamicist. Without Ron, it couldn't have been done. Glenn Beischer, who did wheels and structure, and myself. And we had no money whatsoever. However, I was invited to go and speak at a big Castrol event in Palm Springs. And there I spent a lot of time explaining to them how valuable their brand values were and how important it was to every generation should contribute. And I went back to my table afterwards and the managing director said, "Richard, you're setting us up, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely." He said, "Come and see me when we get back."
And when did you take the decision to step away from the cockpit, and how hard was that decision for you?
This is very difficult. I mean, really very, very difficult indeed, because I don't think people really realize, but doing a project like this is an enormously painful trauma of huge dimensions. You're pushing against the culture. You're pushing against what is kind of normal in motorsport terms and normal in sponsorship terms. You're persuading people to do things that they wouldn't normally do. And you're persuading them to take a gamble on this little team setting out to do something as dangerous as breaking the sound barrier. So it's very, very tough. The other side of it, of course, is the driving, which is not fun. And if you're driving a car like that and you're getting a buzz out of it, you're absolutely the wrong person. It's got to be a really cold-blooded, merciless activity where you're driving to a curve, a performance curve. And if you get it wrong, you're letting the rest of your team down. So, so it's an extraordinary experience, really, one way or another. But together as a team, you know, eventually we pulled it off. So giving it up was a difficult one, but it was the right thing to do. There was no way that I could run the project and drive the car. It was absolutely hopeless.
I was looking through some of your potted history this morning before you came in, and something that I was sort of looking at your various jobs and projects and things like that.
Yeah.
And before Thrust 2 ever raised its head, did you not sell paint?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How do you go from selling paint to a world land speed record?
Well, it's all about, Ed, it's all about motivation and dreams and all the rest of it. And when I was a kid, age 5, my dad, who was in the army and based in Inverness in Scotland, took us for a drive in our Hillman Minx round the north side of Loch Ness. And we stopped at Drum the Drocket, where there's a pier called Temple Pier. And John Cobb's jetboat Crusader was sitting on the pier. And I saw this thing and I thought, wow, that is fantastic. This guy had this fantastic jet-powered boat built, and he was going out and he was driving it at over 200 miles an hour on the lock. What a fantastic thing to do. And it's a bug. It's as really simple as that. So it never really leaves you. And you keep on coming back to it. Simple as that.
So were you ever a motor racing fan, or was that something?
I really wanted to do it, but A, I'm a big bloke, which doesn't help. And secondly, I'd never had enough money. And the great overarching desire was to get that land speed record back.
It does mean going round corners as well, of course.
Yeah, that's a hell of a problem.
Which
though, really is.
You don't have a lot of experience with that.
Though we did do one at 200 miles an hour. That was impressive.
Yes, I bet it was.
What is it about Britain and the land speed record? I mean, our heritage with it is just incredible, going all the way back to the beginning.
I think you, Damon, you've got that absolutely right. There's something very special about this. The land speed record was started by the French in 1898, and they couldn't keep it up. Typical French problem, there you go. They gave up in the 1920s, and the Brits got going. And, of course, what we got was extraordinary things happening at Brooklands, of course. Brooklands, we got this extraordinary culture, which was motor racing and aircraft. The aircraft drew huge, massive crowds. And, of course, the motor racing fraternity, basically, amongst that lot, there were a lot of extremely wealthy people who could afford to have their own cars built for them. It was extraordinary times. And obviously, after a bit, there were two land speed records on Brooklands. And then after a bit, people started to realize that this generated money, generated sponsorship interest. And clearly, to go faster, you needed to move to the beaches and then, of course, to Bonneville and finally to Black Rock.
Richard, you mentioned being inspired by the John Cobb boat.
Yeah.
When was the time you decided I'm not going to do it on water, I'm going to do it on land?
I was never interested in water. Ah. I never really interested in water at all. But, pretty soon I discovered there was a land speed record, and I thought, oh, that's... And, of course, the land speed record is so much faster, so it's much more interesting.
You were mentioning earlier to how it's such a struggle getting all the sponsorship together and persuading people to invest in something in a very small team going after, quite frankly, mad
it's a bloody nightmare.
Target. Mm. Has that not become much easier?
No, not at all. No, because what we're doing, you see, is it's not like a Formula One team where you're just creating another team or you're in for another season. In this case, what you're then doing is raising the bar substantially. So, okay, Thrust 2 was getting the world land speed record back, and people didn't think that could be done. So we did that, and then Thrust SSC was about breaking the sound barrier. And the big companies absolutely terrified about this. They were happily promoting themselves as a great, big, brave British industry. But when you actually put it to the test and said, well, come on, guys, we've done all the research on this, let's get the thing built and go and do it, they run a mile. And now, of course, 1,000 miles an hour, they think that's absolutely impossible and it can't be done, and so on. So it's a hell of a situation.
The 1,000 miles an hour figure, it seems very neat.
Yes, it is very neat. Yep.
And obviously, you did a lot of research into what was possible. And was it really 1,000 miles an hour? Actually, we could do that, or was it a bit faster than that, a bit slower?
It started off in a completely different way. What actually happened was that I was very angry because the Thrust SSC team was never rewarded or recognized for what it actually achieved. And Andy was given an OBE, and frankly, that's pretty miserable. Yeah, the guy should have been knighted. He put his life on the line day after day after day. And when the opportunity came, because basically the Americans had decided they were going to build they were going to challenge with Craig Breedlove's old car, we then realized that this was a chance to actually come back, but not to just break the record by 5 or 10%, but to really show what could be done. And so we decided, on around 30%. However, that was a decision, that was a discussion Andy and I had, but it didn't mean anything because we hadn't actually discussed it with Ron Ayers, the aerodynamicist. So we had a meeting with Ron, and we said, this is what we want to do. And Ron said, how fast? And I said, Mach 1.5. And Ron was absolutely horrified. So there was a bit of a problem there. Bit of horse trading went on, and we ended up at 1.4, which is 1,000 miles an hour. So that's kind of where it started. And then, of course, we had about between 50 and 55 man years of research to fund before we knew we could actually do it.
Really? So you came up with a figure before you even knew whether it was possible, really?
Yes, we believed it was possible, but I mean, that was just pure intuition.
Can we talk about Bloodhound a bit now? Because the whole world is talking about Bloodhound. I mean, you should have seen the number of people at the Goodwood Festival of Speed who were trying to climb over it, onto it, in it, asking
they
questions.
Love it,
I mean, they really love it, and that I was very impressed by that, Richard. And that goes some way to explaining why you've been able to raise the finances thus far.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah.
Well, how much help, if at all, has the government been to you as well as industry? Because it is a great thing for Britain, isn't it?
Yes, it's an extraordinary story. This it really is. The story really starts with the basic concept of the car. And Ron came up with this concept, which is basically a mixed power plant car. In other words, with a jet engine and a rocket motor. So that's where we kind of started. And Andy and I had said, we're going to build the ultimate car. We're not going to be put off by using 30-year-old jet engines anymore. We're going to use the best. And so Andy fixed up this meeting with Paul Drayson, Lord Drayson, who was then the Minister of Defence Equipment and Support. And we had this extraordinary meeting. We were wildly ambitious, hopelessly ambitious. We went to the meeting, and Paul Drayson, of course, is a Le Mans driver, and he really liked the story and everything else. And it went very well until I asked him for the jet engine, and then there was an appalling silence. Clearly, he was not going to deliver the jet engine. And we'd failed. We'd been wildly optimistic. We'd gone to this meeting. We'd failed, and we'd failed at the first hurdle, if you like. So when a meeting like that goes wrong, you know, what you've got to do is stand up and say thank you and walk out, which is what we tried to do. And Paul Drayson then suddenly said, hey, you can do something for us. So I thought, this is most unusual. The minister's asking us for help, but let's see where it goes. So I said, yes, of course. And he said, we have an enormous problem in the Ministry of Defence. We can't recruit engineers. And I said, really? He said, yeah, it's very, very serious. And he said, I've thought about this a lot. And he said, you see, back in the 1950s and the 60s, and to a certain extent the 70s, we had a fantastic aerospace industry, which created things like Vulcan bombers and Concords and Lightnings and TSR-2s. I mean, they really actually led the world. And he said, and we were in the middle of a Cold War, and because we were in the middle of a Cold War, all these things were flying around all the time, and the kids would see them from the schools, and they'd say, wow, that's a Vulcan bomber. Do you realize that can outturn any jet fighter above 60,000 feet? I mean, what a fantastic piece of engineering. And so all these kids got wildly excited by it. And now, of course, we don't do that anymore, and because we don't do that anymore, that essential inspiration just isn't there. So his thought was, I want an inspirational project run through every school in the country to create this new generation of engineers. So I remember the first rule of dealing with ministers is that if they don't like you, you'll never get another meeting. So what you must do is you must fix it then and there. So I stood up, shook the man by the hand, said, we'll do it. He said, I'm not giving you any money. So I said, I don't care, we'll go and do it. So that's where it started.
I've got to bring up a little anecdote from 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I am in the privileged position of having been there, okay? I remember overhearing a conversation you were having one night on the telephone with Rolls-Royce back at home in Britain.
Yeah.
And I won't quote the exact words, but the gist of it was, you know, you're Rolls-Royce, you've got to help me, and if you don't, I'm going to tell the chairman that you're a load of something or others.
Well, not quite.
Well, okay, I'm paraphrasing the conversation.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, about 2 days later, a man from Rolls-Royce turned up.
And so, saved the day. Yes. Absolutely saved the day.
And so what, the point of this anecdote is that... you have to be a special sort of person to get any of this together, don't you? Let's forget the technology and the money. But, I mean, you have personally driven this thing forward, haven't you, with your sort of unbelievable gale force enthusiasm.
It's very generous.
Would that be true?
No, it's a team thing. And the main thing about it is providing these projects are properly managed, properly thought through, properly researched, properly engineered, you can do it. It's really as simple as that. And the big problem we have in Britain at the moment is we've lost our engineering confidence. We don't do these big projects anymore, which is a great, great shame.
So percentage-wise, how far away are you from the budget you need to actually go ahead?
We are, what, in terms of Bloodhound? We've spent 12 million at the moment, and it's going to cost somewhere between 30 and 40.
Wow.
Yep.
And how much of inroads have you made into that 30 or 40 years?
We're beyond a long way in, and there's some wonderful things happening about right now. But sadly, nothing I can talk about.
No.
But got the timing of this thing wrong, didn't you?
I guess in the months to come, will we drip-fed information?
Yes,
about,
you will. Yeah. Absolutely will. There's some just bloody wonderful things happening, yeah.
The education side, I was quite interested in when it was originally launched, because that seemed to me to make complete sense. As you say, turning on the next generation of engineers is harder now than it ever has been in many ways. What reaction have you had from schools and institutions?
Well, it's been fascinating. When we started, of course, you know, they'd all raised eyebrows, and you know, there was a certain amount of interest because of the thrust land speed record history and so on. It really got going when we built a full-scale show car of Bloodhound. And that does 50,000 miles every year, going around schools. We managed to get some early support from the government, which enabled us to get a small team together and get it going. And it's been a huge fight, massive fight. But where we are at the moment now, we're 5,452 schools now. So and these are schools and teachers who've actually signed up to this thing and are actually following it. And it's very exciting because, you see, what's happened is we've really learnt the lesson. And the lesson, curiously enough, came from the Thrust SSC project. So in the early days of Thrust SSC, we were building the car there at Farnborough. And the business was very straightforward. What you did was you tried to generate as much publicity as you possibly could, turn that into money, and spend that on building the car. So that's the process. See, nobody will invest in a thing like this. Because you don't know what your costs are, and you've got no idea whether the thing will ever make a profit or make the shareholders any money. And also the shareholders get frightened by the high level of risk we have to run with these projects, so it's best to do it without them, frankly. So there we go. And so there we are, where we're building the car. And we've done whatever it was, 2 or 3 years of research on thrust SSC, so we know what we're doing, cars building, and suddenly all our media coverage dies. And we're in trouble. We're in terrible trouble because basically no media coverage, no sponsorship, no money, no build. So basically I'm into the car quick and I drive around and I see a lot of editors and the BBC and say, listen, guys, this is a really exciting thing. We're creating the world's first supersonic car. We can do this. We know we can do this. And we've done all the research. We beat the McLaren Formula One team to all that. And we've done it. And now we've got to get this thing built. And why no publicity? And they said, it was very interesting. They said, look, you know, you've got to understand, you've got a niche project here. It's very high technology, and our fundamental problem is our readers won't understand it. It's too difficult for them. And the BBC people were really interesting. We went to the pub, and that was always very important with the BBC guys. We went to the pub, and we said, look, you know, really, what's behind all this? And they said, you've got to understand, Richard, that we are creating programs for a mass market. Your project is very high technology. The level of intelligence, experience, call it what you will, of our audiences is relatively low, and they won't understand this. So we'll be there for you when you start to run the car with all the fire and the noise and the violence and everything else. We'll be there for you. But drawing the bill, no, our readers won't understand. Our audience won't understand this. So then you know, we clearly got the thing really seriously wrong. And the next thing was just a lucky break, because around the corner came the Digital Corporation of America and said, hey, guys, we're looking for show websites. And we said, what's a website? Because we didn't know. And they.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Explained, and we thought, that's really interesting. That's one-to-one communication. That's fantastic. Yeah, let's go with this. So we put a deal together, and then we didn't know what to do on the website. So what we did was we corralled all the engineers and said, right, guys, it's very simple. Treat the web as if you were talking to a good friend in the pub. Tell them all about it. And so everybody got writing on this thing, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And then around the world, the digital people were promoting it heavily, and suddenly it took off. It just skyrocketed. And then, of course, we could do something the BBC could never do, which was go into the website and find out what they were all reading. And they were all reading the technical pages. So we gave them 800 pages of technology, and our website was the fifth largest in the world, larger than the entire motorsport industry.
It's impressive. I mean, because it's Motorsport Magazine podcast, it's worth noting, isn't it, that you mentioned the jet engine and the rocket engine.
Yeah.
But actually, the starter motor is a Cosworth V8.
well, not quite, actually. Oh. Yeah. What we've got is a jet and a rocket. And if we just focus on the rocket, the rocket is 50% more powerful than the jet. So it's a big, big beast. It's the largest hybrid rocket ever built in Europe. It will develop when we've got there, 27,000 pounds of thrust. We're in at 14,000 at the moment. And it's a very nice arrangement, because we use an oxidizer called high-test peroxide, which is the same stuff the girls use on their hair, except it's concentrated...
Some girls.
except it's concentrated to 86%, so if you drop it on the carpet, it sets fire to the carpet. Great stuff. Lovely, lovely stuff. In the long tube bit of the rocket, the combustion chamber, basically at that end, we've got the solid fuel. And the solid fuel is great because it's non-explosive, so you can't even set fire to the solid fuel. It doesn't work unless it's got a tremendous draft of oxygen going down the middle. So then you've got to pump the high-test peroxide, which is heavy stuff. It weighs 1.4 times the weight of water, so it's heavy stuff. And you've got to pump that through at the rate of 1 ton in 17 seconds at 1,000 psi into the front end of the rocket motor, where it meets the catalyst pack and decomposes. And the problem was that we need a lot of power to do this. And so the sensible thing to do was to go for our, a Formula One engine. We needed 800 horsepower. So this all became very, very interesting because the great thing about the Formula One engine is it doesn't need an intake like a small gas turbine, which gives us all those problems. And secondly, it's nice and short and it's light and so on, and it's reliable. So let's enter Cosworth.
So the good old Cosworth V8 is going to be part of doing 1,000 miles an hour.
Well, that's absolutely it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's one of the best engines motor racing's ever seen.
Long live the CA 2010.
Rich,
I remember you telling me a while ago when we met. I think it was down when you with the rocket test, and you said one of the great things about a project like this is you can share all the data, because it's not like a Formula One team, it's not like any other motorsport team. No one's going to copy you. But I did a piece in the magazine end of last year, and we listed some of the sort of your competitors, I suppose. Is there absolutely no worry about them spending all day, every day on your website going like, oh, actually, that's quite interesting, and maybe we should use that?
Well, you see, the thing about it is absolutely fascinating. We owe this one to the teachers, because when we started the education thing, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. So we took stands at education exhibitions like the Bet Show. And the whole idea was to grab the teachers, the STEM teachers, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. So we grabbed the teachers, and in return for an interview there, we would give them a poster and explain what we were doing, etc., and ask them the basic question. First of all, what's it like teaching science, technology, engineering, mathematics? And the teacher says, bloody awful. The kids are absolutely, they're just not interested. Mathematics, they don't want to look at. Physics is way over the horizon, you know. It's very, very serious. And there's not much we can do about this, they said. And so we wanted to say, well, are we doing the right thing here? And they said, well, you really could be, actually. But, and then they started pointing fingers at us and saying, now, look, you've got to understand what you've got to do. This is not going to be a project like a conventional project with press releases and pictures and so on. What you've got to do is you've got to make all that data available so we can follow this stuff in the classroom, bit by bit by bit. And we said, oh, yeah, you know. And it took us far too long to realize that we were in a unique position, because basically with the land speed record, the rules state the car must have four or more wheels and must be driven by the driver, who preferably has got to be inside the car. And and all the cars are therefore completely different. Because they're completely different and because it's emerging technology, what you do doesn't necessarily help a competitor. And then you look at the rest of the world and you realize the defense industry can't do this. The motor race industry certainly can't, because the competition is so tight and the cars are so tightly defined. And the space people can't do it. So we're unique. So we should do it. So that's what we've done.
What is the competition, Richard? I mean, Ed's given me some names here. The North American Eagle is a jet fighter without wings.
They've taken a starfighter and they've taken the wings off it and put it on five wheels. And they have a sort of a different approach to everything. Now, remember, what's happening with this land speed record is we only know one way of doing this. This might just work. I don't think it'll go, they're talking in terms of 800 miles an hour. I doubt it'll actually make supersonic performance, but they're going to be running it this autumn, and we're going to find out.
And another question that people always want me to ask you is, when, and I know you've answered this 1,000 times, but so what, is when is a car not a car? When is it a plane? Now, I think this is a very fair question, actually.
Yeah, it is. And it's very, very simple, because a car depends on its wheels for its stability and its safety. And as long as basically we're on our wheels and we're safe. If we get into the air, we've lost it. We've got no control whatsoever, and we've lost it. So it's most definitely a car.
Okay, so in effect, if you cut the wings off a jet fighter, that is not a car, in my opinion.
Well, okay, as long as it's on the ground, I think it is a car.
Okay.
And the margins between staying on the ground and taking off are, I guess, minuscule.
Yes, you've got to be very, very careful, and you've got to really understand what you're doing here. You see, particularly once you start going into the transonic speed range and starting to generate the shock waves, and the shock waves are areas of extremely high pressure. So, for instance, when thrust as a sea broke the sound barrier, the double bang, ba-boom as they call it, could be heard 40 miles away and 15 miles away in the little town of Gerlach. It shook the school there so much, all the covers of the sprinklers fell off in the classrooms. So you're dealing with enormous forces. And, of course, you know, that's a 100,000 horsepower car, so you're putting huge energy into them. So what you've got to do is you've got to spend an awful lot of time on your aerodynamics, just making sure that you can cope with this. And with Bloodhound, we've made an enormous breakthrough. And at Mach 1.3 and Mach 1.4, there are no shock waves under the car. And this is due to the team in Bristol and the team at Swansea University, particularly to Ben Evans in Swansea, who discovered a trend which we then decided we could then follow, and also to our friends at Intel, who gave us the use of three of the largest high-performance computing clusters in Europe, which then enabled us to run a large quantity of Rolls-Royce software, which actually enabled us to prove it. It was a fantastic thing when it happened, because suddenly we all realised we got it, you know.
Doing Bloodhound now with all the, you know, with all the help from computers, CFD, you name it, do you look back occasionally and think, how on earth did we get away with it with Thrust 2?
Yeah, well, it's a different world, isn't it? In those days, we'd got a lot of very experienced aviation people who'd been involved in building the prototype aircraft and so on, and they got a sort of extraordinary sort of gut feel for it, and this helped us get through.
It's not very reassuring when you're in the cockpit, though, I suppose.
It was a bloody good car. They did really well.
Actually, he looked extremely calm every time he got out of it. I couldn't believe it. He really
did. Well, you come back to that thing that if you're getting emotionally involved in the thing, you're stuffed.
Sure.
And you're a real risk to your team, so that must never happen.
It would certainly not be a job for me.
That pilot training, I guess, comes into play at that stage.
Yeah, in terms of discipline, which I didn't have, which is incredibly important. So, as you know, with an aeroplane, if you're flying along and something goes wrong, you've got to think very, very carefully, very quickly, very logically, because you could so easily take the wrong decision and get yourself into a mess which will kill you.
We have people listening to this motorsport podcast in both North America and in South Africa.
Oh,
and,
good.
And you, of course, are turning your back now on the Black Rock Desert, where you've had so much success, and turning to a desert in South Africa. And I think it would be interesting to learn a little bit about how you prepare this ground, because I know from experience that walking slowly across a desert picking up tiny stones is quite a demanding occupation. I will never forget it, actually.
It's very peaceful, though, isn't it? I mean,
it is very hot and very peaceful.
You're left alone with your thoughts, yeah.
You are, and the third thing is that you hope very, 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 very much that you will not fail to pick up the one thing that gets in the way. Right.
That's right.
Okay, but tell us about how you go about finding a desert to run your... to run Bloodhound, okay? Mm.
Yeah, okay, well, this is largely Andy's story. What happens, of course, is with a land speed record is you've got to match the car to the surface you're going to run it on. And the surface we chose to run on, we learnt the hard way to run on, was called an alkali playa, which is a kind of brown mud lake, dried mud lake with an awful lot of clay in it. And this works very well because it does the job of the tire. Of course, we can't keep a tire on a car at these speeds. And so it does the job of the tire and gives you a nice sort of flexible relationship, if you like, compliance with the earth. So we found the Black Rock Desert and we ran on thrust. We ran thrust 2 and thrust SSC there, and it was great. It was great, successful. We've got a huge number of friends there and people who contributed and everything else.
Sure.
And we obviously with Bloodhound, that's where we got to go. And so Andy went out there and had a look and came back and said, you know, it's a nightmare, Richard. It's all changed. It's got dusty. It's got very, very dusty. And it's formed slight dunes and things. It's absolutely hopeless. We can't do that. So suddenly we've got to find somewhere else, and this is a real problem because you've got the design of the car beginning to come together, and suddenly the place you're going to run isn't. And then so we went to, or rather Andy went to Swansea University and said, help, and they've got a good geographical department there. And they got access to shuttle images and satellite images. So he set up a program to find the flattest places in the world. And I thought, this is really good, you know, because we might find something fantastic in Outer Mongolia, you know, the perfect surface, you know. And he whittled them down to about 30 or so, and then he started traveling around the world looking at these. And it was all pretty disappointing because he kept on getting stuck in them when the surface was soft. Or he found that the surface levels were so low that they were linked in some, probably almost certainly linked in some way to the sea, and so consequently never dried. Yeah. And eventually we came back to South Africa and came to Vernoit Pan, where Sir Malcolm Campbell had been in 1929.
Oh, right.
So we all trooped out to have a look, and we're absolutely amazed to find that his 1929 course was still there. It was absolutely perfect. And we thought, wow, this is fantastic. This is what we've got to do. And by that time, the Northern Cape government was showing a bit of interest, and so they sponsored and financed an engineering look-see. And they came back and said, it's hopeless. I'm afraid the just below the surface are just simply so many stones. You know, it's never going to work. And so we were about to give up when Rudy, who's our track manager, said, hang on, what about Hacking Pan? And I thought, Hacking Pan? Yeah, yes, I remember Hacking Pan, because my brother had been there in the 1980s. And but we'd given up on Hacking because it had a road on a causeway across the middle and an awful lot of stones, but it was very, very flat. Anyhow, one thing led to another. The Northern Cape government decided that they were going to back it, and so now we'd got to change Hacking Pan. And so we had to remove 1.6 kilometres of road on a causeway across the middle and level all that off. And then there was a small matter of the stones. Now, the desert itself is amazingly flat. So we took an analysis of this on a section of this, and we found that over 2 kilometres, the dip in the middle was 60 millimetres. So, and the local kids won't play football on it because their balls just disappear over the horizon, you know, there's nothing to stop them. And amazing place. But the only problem was these stones. And the Northern Cape government said, right, we'll deal with that. And so they employ 300 people from the local village, where there's 98% unemployment. And these guys get going. And they've been going for 2 years. And each person has picked up 20 tons of stones by hand.
It's a fantastic.
So 6,000 tons, 21 million square meters of stones. And it's fantastic. And it's very much a sort of society out there which is driven by the women. It's matriarchal society, and so the women are there and they're brushing the desert, and they're leaving it, you know, better than your floor here in motorsport. It's absolutely amazing. And I got into terrible trouble here because we took an aeroplane, landed there, and we got a real bollocking for doing that.
Yes, I suppose you did.
But it's a beautiful, beautiful job.
It's a remarkable story,
and
isn't it?
And if anybody wants to go and have a look, then drive up to Hacking Pan and have a look. It's a hell of an achievement. It really is.
Is that going to be the limiting factor in 50, 100 years' time? There's going to be nowhere on Earth that you're going to be able to get beyond, you know, a certain speed.
It's certainly one of the limiting factors. There are three limiting factors. One is the power-to-weight ratio of the car, which controls the rate at which it accelerates. Secondly is the ability of the driver to withstand the accelerations. And thirdly is the length of the course that's available. So at Black Rock Desert, we had 13 and a half miles. And here at Tank Scheme, we've got 20 kilometers. So the car's designed to do it in 20. And in terms of the acceleration, it's really very interesting. I was once very privileged to have dinner with Jim Lovell, the astronaut. And so we started talking about all this. And I said, well, come on, Jim, well, you know, you've got much more experience than we'll ever have. What's your view on this? And he said that when they were doing the Gemini flights and when they were being injected into orbit there, basically they were pulling 9G. So he's pulling 9G acceleration. And so Bloodhound is 2G acceleration and 3G deceleration. So we've got a long way to go.
You mentioned the schedule being 2015 and 2016 for the runs. Could you go into a bit more detail about that, about how it's planned, and presumably every time you run, you've got specific targets you want to achieve?
Absolutely, yeah. Now, so basically, we aim to roll out the car in about May 2015. Then we'll take it down to Newquay, where we've got an operational base there. And that's where we'll start running it. We won't run it very fast, 200 miles an hour, just get a feel for it, make sure that everything works all right. And then we'll quickly load it all into the plane and go straight out to an airfield called Upington in South Africa. And then we've got a sort of about a two and a half hour drive to get to Hexking Pam. Once we're on the Pam, we start very, very slow. We'll probably start at about 100 miles an hour, just basically feeling our way. And the name of the game is that as you do more and more runs, so you obviously increase the speed by relatively small increments until we start getting transonic, and then you do very small increments while we just get ourselves sorted. Once we've got to supersonic, then of course we can perhaps increase the increment rate. So the idea is in 2015 is to go up with the car and using the rocket motor in what we call its monophase. So there it's simply decomposing the test peroxide. We haven't got the hybrid combustion chamber on the end. And that's sufficient to get us supersonic. So we'll go out there and we'll get it supersonic. We'll find all sorts of things don't work. We'll find all sorts of changes what we have to make. And then we'll immediately bring the car back home, take it all apart, refix it, sort it, and then go out again in 2016 with the hybrid rocket, and then we've got the capability of 1,000 miles an hour.
I must say, it all makes Grand Prix racing sound rather straightforward, doesn't it? I mean, you know.
It makes it sound very quiet, actually. I mean, this thing makes 25 times the noise of a jumbo taking off, so I mean, it's a serious noisy machine.
I hope you've warned the local people who kindly picked up all these stones.
No, they are lovely, actually, because, we all go and see them on a regular basis. Sure. And, as far as they're concerned, they all say it's our car. When is our car coming, Richard? Get on with it.
Yeah. It's a bit like the community of Gerlach, where we were in 83, where, I mean, the entire community was not only excited and thrilled to be part of it, but lived it. I mean, you know, and will live it forever, because and then SSC later on.
Yep.
And it becomes a real community thing. And I can't imagine... Where is everybody going to live in this place that you're describing?
Well, that's quite an interesting point. We've got to establish a camp. We've actually got to live on the desert. And the other thing, which is the number of good things, really good things about Hexking Pan, one is the altitude. So it's at about 3,000 feet, which is where we want to be. If we were lower, then the car would have to be made tougher because the dynamic forces are great, pressures are greater, and therefore the acceleration rate would be heavier and its acceleration rate would be less and we'd need more track. So that's one. The other thing is that, unlike America, we've got about an 8-month weather window, which is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
In America, we've only got about 6 weeks, so you've got to go like hell, otherwise, the weather catches you out and you've got to stop. So here we've got 8 months. So the grand plan is to be out there in the British summer, which is the South African winter, start running there, work it through over a period of 2 to 3 months, get ourselves supersonic, and then come home and go into the rebuild.
I mean, the weather is, I remember, crucial, because I do remember those mornings where everybody was walking around looking as though all their grandparents had died at once. And that meant we're not running today.
Yep.
And, of course, that is very disruptive.
Just recently, I think one of the milestones you've just passed is actually the forging of the wheels.
Yep.
It was one of those facts that just sort of blows your mind. Correct me if I'm wrong. On the rims of these wheels, they'll be exerted to, is it 55 G?
55,000 G.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So Andy's got a lovely expression here, which is if you were to put a kilogram bang of sugar on the wheel rim and somehow it stayed there at 10,500 RPM, then basically it'd be the equivalent of loading that wheel rim up with a fully loaded articulated truck.
Wow. And who's making them?
Right, Otto Fuchs have been doing the forging in Germany. And,
oh, that's a shame. They're not British.
No, we can't do that in Britain anymore. And a wonderful company called Castle Precision Engineering are machining them up in Glasgow.
In Britain,
yeah.
Good, good. Because I think we're all, we may not be as mad about this as you are, Well, if we were, we'd be doing it, wouldn't we? But we all hope, I think, that Bloodhound will produce more engineers in Britain, because that would be the best possible result.
Well, we've got no problem with this. It's creating enormous numbers of engineers already. It's very, very interesting, this. You see, the fundamental thing is that the schools have been actually deprived of engineering, largely because of health and safety issues, because basically we didn't do this in Britain anymore, and so on. And so there we arrive on the scene and we introduce them into Bloodhound, where it's very interesting, where it's not just a collection of people just doing something. We're a collection of people busting our guts to create the most innovative and creative car that's ever been made. So, the kids really empathize with this. Then what's happened? The figures are very interesting, and it's worth just recording that. One of our sponsors is the University of West of England, and over the last 3 years, because they've been sponsoring Bloodhound, their engineering intake has doubled. Yep. And we now, as I say, have 5,452 schools on it. There's a huge level. I mean, the kids are now building rocket cars now, and just recently the playground land speed record has been raised to 204 miles an hour across the playground.
This is pretty impressive.
This is serious stuff. It's bloody brilliant, isn't it? It's really great.
Well, it is actually bloody brilliant. About describes it.
And it's going to have an enormous effect. The interesting thing was, the other night I was at a dinner with Vince Cable speaking, and he said the interesting thing is this. Is our problem is that we only create around 32,000 physics A-level successes per annum.
Right.
From all those schools. And of those 32,000, we probably get 30,000 engineers from that. So we're only producing 30,000 engineers. And he then went on to say that Britain is absolutely the worst in Europe in terms of gender balance. And in 50% of all the state co-educational schools, there is not one girl with physics A level.
It strikes me you've got to do another book.
I guess so. At some stage, yes.
So, well, is that yes? You will? Or?
Well, we've done an interesting book which is selling very, very well at the moment. Now it's only available from the Bloodhound website, but is the Rolex book on the car technology? Because you see, the point about it is that we're making all this technology available. There's a huge amount of data and everything going out, but the fundamental thing is that what was needed was a book for people to really understand this thing. And this beautiful book has been produced and is selling in very large numbers, which is absolutely great. So that's the start. And then, of course, there are going to be a lot of books about the struggle to get this thing together and beat the British system and all the rest.
I had a quick look on Amazon before you came in, and your lot, they're so few and far between. The one price I saw for a book on Amazon was £162.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in demand. So it's about time you wrote another one.
Yeah, that's a thrust. As you see, we produced 59,000 of those hardback, and they were never remanded.
I have a signed copy. I wonder what it's worth. Anyway, we've got some questions from the Motorsport Magazine podcast listeners.
Oh, good. Okay. Great. God, right. I hope I can answer them. Yeah.
Can anybody hear me? There's an amazing noise outside. I think it's a ship going up the river. Anyway, Ed Markwick wants to know, Richard, if you do break the 1,000-mile-an-hour barrier, what speed would your next attempt be?
Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much. This is absolutely the last one. We're never, ever going to go through this trauma and pain and aggro ever again.
You heard it here first.
He sounds like Steve Redgrave, doesn't he? Didn't listen to him either.
Yeah, that's right. maybe
we could put maybe Ed's question could be put a slightly different way, and that is, after 1,000 miles an hour, presumably in years to come, somebody will go quicker.
Oh, for God's sake, yes, I hope so. I really hope so. I mean, the thing about it is that providing we're successful with this, and we believe it's going to generate enormous coverage. It's being followed on the web now in 220 countries.
Yeah, sure.
The only ones we haven't got, curious enough, are North Korea, which you might expect, and Vatican City. So if anybody knows the Pope, perhaps they can give him a nudge.
I think you're the man to nudge the Pope, Richard. The next question comes from GMR Design. Do you know GMR Design? No. Okay.
No, I don't. No.
They want to know, Richard, whether you've considered supercharging the V8 Cosworth fuel pump to reduce stresses and increase fuel economy.
Hmm. Well, basically, there's no real reason for that. Basically, the way we've got it set up, it uses very, very little fuel. And as far as we're concerned, you know, that would mean a huge amount of development for very little gain. It delivers the power we want, and that's it, frankly. I don't want to meddle with it.
I think that particular question from GMR Design is interesting in itself, in that it illustrates what you've been saying, that people are taking an interest in the detail.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really good news.
What if I could just jump in? If you, what's your? Do you have a main area of concern on the project? Is it the rocket, or is it the aerodynamics, or is there anything at the moment that you're still slightly scratching your head with?
Yeah, we've got a few, but they're not the big major concerns we had right at the start of the project, which is like the aerodynamics. You know, that's all gone away now. That's gone away, and the structures and the way we build the car, and etc. That's all gone, and now it's just money and get the thing finished.
Okay, we're nearly at the close of our podcast today, but another question before we go from Phil Retzas. And it says, Phil Retzas says, did you manage to fix anything on Thrust 2 or Thrust SSC by hitting it with a hammer?
No, Phil, I wouldn't dare.
I think his point being that, you know, 30 years ago,
yeah, things yes, were... you would have bent something or banged something, sure. But no. These are very high technology vehicles, and they've got to be treated with great respect.
Absolutely. Okay. And finally, Daniel Sloan just says, Richard, you must write another book. The last one was brilliant.
Oh, that's very generous of him.
And seeing as you're never going to do one of these projects again, you'll have plenty of time to write the ultimate book.
Well, there's some fantastic stories in Bloodhound. I mean, unbelievable stories here. So I believe it,
as there were with Thrust 2, we remember. And we're going to be celebrating in October the 30th anniversary. And all us thrusters, that includes everybody who was there, you know, even if we were only talking about it. We'll be hopefully having some kind of drink.
Yeah, we've got to do that.
To celebrate
we've
30
really
years. Yeah,
no,
he might turn up, you never know, passing through. Anyway, thank you very, very much,
My
Richard.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And we don't normally tackle land speed records on Motorsport Magazine, but I'm very glad we did, because it shows you, doesn't it, the amount of effort and technology and detail that goes into it, just like modern Formula One.
Yeah, I think in terms of the magazine's always followed land speed record from the beginning, and I think it's a very important part of motor racing heritage is that chase to be the fastest on land. I think it's a very important part, and we'll be following it closely from here on.
Good.
As we have been up to now.
Absolutely.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's totally right, Damien, actually, because all the great names of British land speed records have always featured in Motorsport magazine, haven't they? I remember my father pointing them out to me. Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll join us again next month. Meanwhile, it's goodbye from us at Motorsport Magazine. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.